come on in.
Paul, nice to see you. Yes. Yeah. Mira, there's room here. Yeah, right here. First, let me tell you why I'm here. First, to apologize for stealing John and Amanda. And this is not something new in our tradition. We have been doing it for ages. And see here the reward you got. You got Jackie. And you, otherwise, I don't think that, you know, Jackie and Julia and all these people, they could have come forward with that much, you know. Yeah, we got to, you know. But I did not have any such intention, you know. My intention was just purely selfish. You know, to have John, and but in long run I had very noble objective to achieve, and which I'm achieving, you know, and that is good for everybody. So once again I apologize, and with that I will also another second reason. I have come here just to open my mouth just literally this time, sometimes in April or maybe August, September, toward the end of this year, then I will tell you that where and how I see all the centers, you know, whether they are in India, Africa, here, where the institute is moving as one entity, you know, and all of its members. And lots of things are happening, as John was telling me today, when we started our Yoga International digital magazine plus digital classroom, we had 2,000 visitors a day. Now we have 20,000 visitors a day. You know? And when in June or little earlier, our Facebook following was, I think, 7,000-8,000. That was, you know, we started. Now we have gone beyond 250,000. We have 270,000, you know, people. And this is what time to time we must evaluate ourselves, re-examine ourselves, just as in any organization. Spiritual organizations also have to look at themselves and study that what is happening in the world. And what is there that we must, you know, get ready, you know, in order to serve better. Just you guess, where is the largest number of people, most concentrated city in terms of our Facebook followers? You just guess. Try to come up with. Keep going. Not Buffalo, not Chicago, not New York City, not Los Angeles, not England, not Tokyo. Completely, just, and when I tell you the name of the city, that will tell you what institute really stands for and what people are really, in the cosmos, what the collective consciousness is really asking us to do. Tehran. Wow. Tehran, capital of Iran. See here, there is a pain, there is a sorrow, there is anger, there is disruption, you know. There is upheaval, you know. Himalayan Institute has the largest, you know, Facebook followers in Tehran. You know? So there is some message in it. And it is in response to that message. In fact, I was, you know, contemplating, looking at, when in 1993 Swamiji put me in the position where I am, I asked him a question. Anything, what is message for me, what am I supposed to do? As many of you know, those who have seen Swamiji and lived with him, he was extremely brief. If he's playing with children and having, you know, fun, then he makes all kinds of statements. But normally, when it is serious matter, he didn't make big lectures, big statements. So he told me, serve the sages. How more ambiguous it could be. Serve the sage in what manner? Have their statue, built everywhere, hang their photos, Or let's say, start translating their teachings or, publish pamphlets and start telling, hey, you guys, we are the followers of the sages of the Himalayas, create one more cult. What do you mean, So, but as time on, goes on, things keep unfolding what we are supposed to do. And this is what really is perfect topic. And who chose the topic for this tonight, Did you or Jackie? How did it come about, this Himalayan tradition and our modern life? Who did it? You did it?
Yes, Sarah did it.
Me and Jackie. All came together.
Okay, that's great. So the other piece of the information I will share with you, when I make my next visit to Africa, which I'm just looking for right time, right way of doing it, there is something that Institute is very, very well positioned to do and that we can do. It was first time the inspiration to go to Africa came when I went to Mount Kailas, Tibet, in June of 2004. I went first in 1999. Second time I went in 2004, 5 years later. And that's when the inspiration came. And it was so strong that instead of really flying to Hansdale, Meera and myself, we flew to Africa without knowing where should we go. It's just, I have to go and see that continent, what is happening there, what are the people. And so 2004, that was the one quick visit was in September 2004. That was just touching the continent. And then it was December, middle of December in 2004. We went to Uganda. Then after that, we kept making so many trips. I made 7 trips to Uganda, and Ishan, my son, he did 11 trips. Uganda, Tanzania, Kenya, and all those South Africa. Finally, we settled down in West Africa after doing many, many projects, most of which from worldly perspective, it failed. And then finally, we settled down in Cameroon, that is West Africa. So now, where should we go? What should we do? What are the... If there are 250,000 people, and the way it's growing, very soon we'll have 500,000 people, and my guess is probably by the end of this year, otherwise definitely by the time we go to Khajuraho, we'll have millions of people, access, to us, and we will have access to them. Now, what is there that we must do, And in terms of serving most efficiently. And that part I will talk to. And if there is any place where I'll open my mouth first is Buffalo. And always there has been some unique history about it. So these were my 2-4 reasons why I thought I must come before it gets later. Very soon my lecture tour will begin. And so then again I will come back as part of the Yoga Sutra lecture tour in the month of June. I'm coming back. Well, the Himalayan tradition in modern life. Let me tell you a few things. And, whom I'm missing is Nancy, probably is not here. Please, our all the great mothers and grandmothers, those who have been the powerhouse of the Himalayan Institute here, before I leave, I wish to give them a call. Otherwise, Jackie, make sure that you give them a call, and my love, and greetings to them. And, let me tell you the tradition, about tradition. Book is coming out very soon, the Yoga Sutra of Patanjali, which is our cardinal seminal text in the tradition. And this is the first time I'm going into a little bit more detail than what Swamiji went in the Living with the Himalayan Masters regarding the tradition. There was a book compiled in 10th century AD or 11th century AD by a master who is said to have lived long, long time, at least couple of hundred years lifespan he had. And that's very well documented fact in our tradition. His name is Vidyaranya Yati. In fact, my small book that you have written, the Himalayan Masters, the Living Tradition, there is one whole chapter on that master. I think toward the end, there is a chapter on this great saint. So he wrote a book, which is very, very big book, in three volumes, and several thousand pages long book. And if you publish and print and do the proper kind of pagination the way our modern printing, publishing industry, demands, then it will be at least 10,000 page long book. That was the most monumental work that has been done almost like 1,000 years ago. In that scripture, this saint, this great yogi, is writing about where our lineage began. So by the time his great grandmaster, that is Shankaracharya, who formally founded the tradition in 8th century AD, there had been 71 teachers. And Shankaracharya is the 71. Patanjali is the 40th. Vyasa, the 23rd. Sorry, 21st, 21. And Kapila, K-A-P-I-L-A, Kapila is the first master, who officially, gave the formal shape to our tradition. And then after that again, then there is another 1,200 years of history. I'll give you few ideas, what some time to time these teachers have done. That tells us exactly how the knowledge and wisdom is time to time retranslated, reintroduced, repackaged, in order to meet the need of contemporary societies. Even in past 40, 45 years' time, Swamiji came to this country in 1969, the founder of the Himalayan Institute. That was an amazing time in American history. And in post-World War II, America had been experiencing a great deal of prosperity. With that also had come a great wave of experimenting with all different kinds of lifestyles. That was also, the people were were totally fed up with the war and violence. War of Korea, Vietnam, Cold War with Russia. So people are kind of fed up, totally disappointed. They had already come to a conclusion that this is not the right way to live. But if that is not the right way to live, what is the right way to live? We have money, we have everything that we want to have, and yet people were not so super satisfied with the outcome of the life, with the outcome of the lifestyle they had. And that is the time great wave of teachers from India, Southeast Asia came. That is the time when, in fact, Dalai Lama, if I were an academic person somewhere in an academic institution giving this lecture, I can give a totally unique way of presenting His Holiness Dalai Lama, that how he came, what is the major force behind his success, all that. There was a great demand for peace, compassion, something that is antidote to violence, antidote to this complicated lifestyle. So, similarly, the founder of TM, Mahesh Yogi, Swamiji, Swami Muktananda, Swami Satchidananda, Swami Vishnu Devananda, Swami Chinmayananda, and many, many of these, and then many teachers from Tibet and Korea, all they came here and they had their niche. That is how the yoga came to the United States. In the beginning, almost every teacher introduced yoga in a much, much broader sense than what we see today you know, in our modern yoga community, where now today yoga has shrunk to mainly to the asana. No? And but in those days, 40 years ago, 50 years ago, it was a holistic approach to understanding of spirituality. That was the main impetus. Therefore, what is there that we can adopt, we can embrace, so that at the level of our body, mind, consciousness, at the level of our society, family, culture, both at personal level as well as at interpersonal level, we become a healthier and happier person. You know? That was the approach. And slowly, slowly, that approach, you know, somehow it stayed in theory, but in practice it went in a different direction. Now, as the survey tells us, that there are around 15 to 20 million Americans, maybe even more, who are practicing yoga. And there is a great deal of this curiosity, what is next? No? It's there. So this kind of thing happened. It happened in just in 50 years' time. And then you look at what could have happened in 2,000 years' time, and how many times the need for certain things must have gone up and must have gone down. And in response to that, they say, a tradition that is grounded in such a, you know, profound antiquity must have done great, great changes, must have changed its methodology and way of teaching. So here, in this context, let me remind a few things. Just one example I'll give you. That is the example of this last master yogi almost 1,000 years ago. What did he do when he saw in India a great deal of turmoil? Turmoil which is somewhat parallel to what we see today in Africa and Middle East. India was almost like a lawless country at that time. There were tens of thousands of rajas, and hardly any of them had any system of justice and court. When you look at the history of India, it is so shocking that in real sense, the system of court was re-established by the British in India. There was no law and order. The local king, feudal king, whatever he thought was right, he just did it. No? Right means whatever was convenient to him. Great deal of oppression. And especially the caste system was just horrible. And women in India, they had just started getting some rightful place in the society. Otherwise, it was very bad. And whenever anyone tried to say that this is a problem, let's fix it, immediately, the Hindu majority of India always pointed their fingers to the Muslims. That is because of the Muslims, this problem is here with us in our country, which had not been that correct. You know, society was already very fragile. This is the history we hear. So what this great teacher 1,000 years ago, he noticed that there has to be, we have to have a reinterpretation, we have to reinterpret spirituality. You know, and we have to bring something, you know, new and fresh in the society. And I'm just bear little with me, because this is what exactly happening in our modern time too. You know, not much difference. And history just keeps repeating itself. You know, keeps repeating itself. So he undertook a massive project. He was a very charismatic sage, master. His story is very long. He picked two brothers from a small ruling family, very small ruling family. They were like landlords in South India. Their parents were landlords. And then he started teaching these two young boys. Gave them all the knowledge, and meanwhile, he kept introducing more resources, kept inspiring. And these two kings, Harihar Rai, Bukka Rai, finally they established one of the biggest empire, in so-called medieval history of India. And medieval period of India begins somewhere in 9th, 10th century AD, unlike in Europe, which is medieval period, probably Renaissance period, maybe 14th, 15th century, so on. And there, a massive project. Today, if you went, today you visit India, South India especially, there are water tanks. He created a unique project. He introduced unique projects. First thing, let's say, at the very, very social and environmental level he undertook the project, paying attention to the water resources. And he undertook massive projects of building literally thousands of water tanks. And it became part of the culture thereafter that if you build a temple, you have to have a pond. If you are a rich man, how rich you are is totally useless unless you have built a pond. You show off your richness. No? Even though it's a little not very sattvic kind of your prosperity, you are showing off, but yeah, it's human nature. If you want to show off in doing something good. Still it's better than sitting inert or hiding your wealth somewhere in a hole. So the water tank. Next to the water tank, if you are a rich person, plant trees. And the best trees to be planted, which do not bear fruits which are edible to humans. Bizarre concept. And if you want to go a little bit, few more steps further, then in a very mysterious way, deep in the bottom of the much, several feet below your, in the floor of the tank, water tank, you bury some coins in this corner, that corner, that corner, in a very ritualistic manner, fill the whole pond with water. It means do as big publicity as you can. Let people know that in this pond, there are ritualistically worshipped coins buried. And of course, as time will pass, people will forget who owns the water tank, because especially if the country is not so, governed by democratic laws. And then the story keeps making round that those who dig the pond and put the the dirt and the soil and the clay outside the pond, they might get the coin. So that is how lots of these ponds survive up to this day. Driven by this desire, discovering the wealth buried deep. Sometimes once in a century somebody gets few coins here and there. Whether the coin are gold coins, silver coins, copper coins, it's not written anywhere. Where exactly, in what part of the pond? It's not written. There is no map for it. So water tank, planting trees, putting some coins in the pond. So the later people forgot that why the coins. So now what they do? You know, in India, when people go to take bath in Ganga, they throw a coin in Ganga, in the river. The whole idea was, do in a manner that it has some positive impact, reason behind it. That was at the social level, I mean environmental level. Then education, he established system of education, health. And in the education system, what he did, which was like a system that had been discontinued for a long time, and that was the people had stopped teaching non-spiritual subjects in their universities and colleges. So-called spiritual subjects, philosophy, had become only the dominant factor, and hardly there was, you know, an organized system of, studies in art, crafts, music, dance, sciences, mathematics. The result was, India was producing a good number of philosophers, but no practical people. You know? How much can you eat philosophy? You know? You are hungry, and all you have is just philosophy. So when you look at the literature, in the last 1500 years, 2000 years, it is just shocking. Between the time of Buddha and 1000 years AD, there are hardly just few books on commerce called Kautilya Arthashastra that was written in 2nd or 3rd century BC. In entire history, there are only two books on Ayurveda, Charak Samhita and Susrut Samhita. They were written in 3rd century or 4th century or 2nd century AD. My God, 2000 years have gone by and people did not feel need to again conduct some research on herbs or any, you know, medicines, you know, in response to our environment, food, habits, behaviors, new diseases come into existence, you know. And therefore, you have to continue conducting research so that you keep up with, you know, on what the way and same pace, the space at which new problems are manifesting. You have to keep up with that pace in terms of discovering the solution. India didn't do that. No? And it is only just recently, yoga became popular not because Indians did great job. It's Americans who did it. So now the yoga is being re-imported, going back to India. All the best yoga institutions in India, they are run by Americans. No? Okay? They are funded by Americans, run by Americans, you know. And they conducted the research. Same thing with Ayurveda. You go to India, you will be shocked. Hardly anybody goes to Panchakarma. All Panchakarma is due to that Americans understood the value of it. And then they started doing it in India. Now people go to India. But in the same very center where the, you know, non-Indians are getting all the Ayurvedic services, Indians don't go. You know. This is a very, very ground level reality I'm sharing with you. Philosophy, you know. Sanskrit, for example, it is only after I came to the United States, I could see that there are so many different ways of making a good use of the knowledge that is buried in vast Sanskrit literature. Credit whatever I am able to do today. Of course, the main credit goes to the founder who was so broad-minded, who had such a vast experience of East and West, ancient and modern, that is Swamiji, Swami Rama. But he showed me the path and he gave me the idea. But it was my study at the University of Pennsylvania that has given me some ways of, you know, putting my ancient knowledge into a practical manner. Not my first PhD and all that thing that I had done in India itself. That was like raw, no material. It's like, yes, here is mine. Have your tiny, tiny tools and keep digging that mine. And you have to have tools and means in order to do the proper kind of mining. And after the mining is done, then you have to cut the diamond and polish it. And then you present it properly. And all that methodology I learned at the University of Pennsylvania. Not in India. So what this great master did, exactly that's what, you know, he organized a humongous group. So he dedicated his resources, and which, again, These two young boys, they grew up, became great warrior, great ruler, and they established their empire. It's called very famous empire in India. Those who have taken courses in Indian history, it's called Vijayanagaram Empire. One of the most prosperous empire in past, 1400 years, 1500 years or so in India. Now that king was raised, he was those two brothers and two brothers, both kings. So what he did, he split the kingdom. Okay, you rule here, but here is exactly, this is a new, it's like having two kings, it's unheard of. Same kingdom, but two kings. And they ruled so beautifully. So they channeled their resources into many, many, quote, non-spiritual directions. They understood the value of human beings have to have food, cloth, shelter, protection, And therefore, different universities, colleges, and that is when they started funding, and great revival of many universities, Varanasi and Allahabad, Vikramshila, Ujjain, and goes on, list can go on. This is where we have reached in a different setup, different context. We have reached in a similar place somewhere in our very unique way. Now, just to imagine that when Swamiji came 45 years ago, actual classes were taught in a classroom setting. The need for actual classroom setting and interaction between teacher and student is never going to vanish. It's a reality with certain things you share, like I gave this Living Tantra course, digital. But there is a very unique beauty. Certain things just by watching the faces, people's reaction on their faces, and spontaneously, things, my presentation change, it changes. And always there is a new thing. Even though it's same old subject I'm teaching, but each time I teach, there is something new comes out. And yet, today that has become the prime means to teach at the universities and colleges, as Himalayan Institute cannot be, cannot remain unaffected by this methodology, digital methodology. As a result, I'll share with you some very unique experience. And in fact, during the chai time, we were talking about it, when I came, and having my chai. One gentleman into mining industry, iron ore mining in Mauritania, that is in Western Africa. It was a great thing to discover that this person sits really in Sahara Desert. And due to his access to the government of Mauritania and the kind of scale of his industry there, he had 3-4 years ago, even when Living Tantra series started, he had leased satellite connection in the middle of nowhere in Africa. Here is our course is going on in Hansdale Auditorium, and here the owner of the mine, Anil Reddy from South India, on his laptop, and his another partner, barrister from England, and his top-ranking geologist and agriculturist, they are taking Living Tantra course sitting in Africa. And look at what happens there. One day he called me with mixed feelings. Thrilled that he is able to study even though he is not here in Hansdale. And imagine how Just imagine how good I must have been feeling at that time when somebody who is totally hardcore businessman, and you have a super, super hardcore with very, very tough heart to be involved in mining, especially in Africa. It's a hard place. And mining on top of that is even hard, one of the hardest business. And such a person is taking courses on Tantra. The course which really triggered him was The Secret of Tantric Rituals. That was one of the weekend seminar. In that seminar, I was explaining that how everything in nature is so fully connected. Life within us and life outside us, it's just totally connected, and the true health, wealth, peace and happiness comes when all these different aspects of our life are fully integrated, are not disjointed. Also, I was explaining that how in different aspects of nature, herbs, minerals, grains, they have certain healing powers. And how the healing powers of these herbs are tantrically awakened by doing certain meditative practices and fire offerings and by reciting mantras. And then the discussion led us in the classroom to see that what is so-called God, divinity, sanctity, sacred, according to tantric worldview. Life itself is very sacred. Everything is sacred. This world has come from primordial Mother Nature. She is very beautiful. And everything here in this world has, intrinsically is infused with two great properties, and properties which lead us to lasting fulfillment and ultimate freedom. Therefore, nothing in the world is bondersome. Rather, everything here has a property which can help us find our freedom and fulfillment, provided we understand the mystery of those objects, mystery of those things, and exactly how they relate to our personal life. This person looking at, reading, studying, making very much sense, then he felt so horrible. What is he doing with mining? He looked at, later on he invited me 2-3 years ago, Mira, myself, and a couple of more people, we went from Hansdale. He invited us to visit his place. Later, and there are many, many other miners, people from the mining industries from Australia and Canada and India, China, all they are there. Just when you see the place, just literally mountains just torn apart and have turned into just like you, big, big mountains have turned into gravels. And then, depending on whether, let's say, iron, for example, there are two kinds, magnetite and other one, hematite. So, two different kinds of, iron ore. One has magnetic properties by nature, another does not. So, different way of very, very basic fundamental processing they do. In the process, just literally, you just see miles and miles and miles of complete trash. Just like bosom of the earth is just ripped off. And he's sitting there in his camp, in his article RV, those which he had temporarily bought from China, and just sitting there, and water comes from 200-300 kilometers away in big containers. So just sitting there, my God, this is what I'm doing here? For what? And is it possible that the need for these natural resources will ever be met? And this is going on for last so many 100 years. If tiny little Western Europe could cut down the virgin timber of the United States, which is many, many, many times bigger than the entire Europe, And still, it wasn't enough. Still there is a need for, you know. Similarly with very many other things, you know. What am I doing here with my mining? Anything other than money? And also, what is the purpose of the money? He was quite distraught, you know. So we talked on the telephone, then he comes to Hansdale. Very supportive of Institute's work, both in India and here, also Africa. This particular family I'm talking about. And so we discussed this matter. That's where he took some very bold, he made some very bold decision about doing something different. Logic was, from my side, I said, Anil, his name is Anil Reddy, Anil, if you don't do what you are doing, somebody else is going to do it, perhaps you will do it in 100 times in worse and destructive manner than you can do. This human nature. As long as you can do it a little bit more wisely, and as long as you can, you know, channel some of your, the outcome of the, you know, your work for something good and constructive, which has a, you know, much, you know, positive and constructive, you know, impact on environment and human race, that will be good. He understood the value of it. So see here, today, this is just an example of what Himalayan tradition, the tradition of these ancient sages, can do, should do, must do in order to meet the need of our modern society. No? Just look at yourself. You know, here we have young people, we have middle-aged people, we have men, we have women, we have people from all walks of life. Those who have come here for satsang, I'm quite sure that majority of you must be taking or must have taken Hatha Yoga Asana classes. Am I correct? Can you raise your hands? How many of you have taken or taking? You know, quite large number of you. No? And yet, there is a this process going on in all of you, in all of us. This process is going on in me, in you, in all of us. That what is life? How can, and especially when we come closer to a certain place in our life, somehow it's very mysterious. The 50th birthday is very mysterious. Certain things happen to us, but we try our best to ignore it and deny it. But by the time we cut our 60th birthday cake, it becomes unavoidable. No? We can clearly see that on one hand, our intellectual comprehension and resources have expanded. And physically, we are kind of shrinking. It's no longer the same vitality and strength and stamina. Thirty years ago, if I did not sleep for more than 3-4 hours a day, I could drag my body for a couple of weeks, no? Non-stop, you know, I could go. Now I need to be more, I need to have more structured life, you know, so that I don't collapse. But by the time we are in our late 60s, then 70s and 80s, then some things really happens to us. We begin to wonder that, yes, here, if I continue doing whatever I have been doing, that's okay, but for what? What's the end result of it? How does it really make sense? How much does it make sense? Okay. By that time, even if you want your children to be around you, they don't want to be around you, you know? They have their own life, no? And nature starts telling, no, that now you don't need to, even you don't need to really break all the bonds, no, but yes, something deep inside us tells us that now this is time to reflect on certain important issues, and also some same very force tells us that everything what we thought in life was important is really not that important. What is so important, I might not know that, but this thing has come to this realization that whatever so far I kept thinking that it was really that important, it's not that important. What is so important, I may not know it. I may not know it, but I know it very well that all those things are really not that important. This is like nature's way of giving us next level of wisdom, you know, provided we pay attention to it. You know? And this is where Himalayan Institute can do something really very profound and should do profound. This is what this modern world is asking. People's lifespan has expanded, you know, throughout the world. People are living longer. It's a great blessing. But with that blessing comes a great curse. You know? The quality of life is not, you know, that great. By the time we are in our 60s, 70s, you know, we start seeing the number of, you know, the cases of our Alzheimer's, for example, is going up. Is it because something really has gone wrong and that's why? Or is it because people are living long? Maybe perhaps combination of the two. You know? And definitely the life is kind of disintegrated. Life is fast. Life is, and anything that we are doing, even our devices are getting shorter and shorter in terms of information segment, you know. So that's what, you know, we are watching here, and this I wish to share with people a little bit from a spiritual angle, that what is going on even in Hansdale, for example. When 30 years ago, I lectured, if I went a little bit beyond time, it wasn't a big deal. Okay? Now it's a very big deal. Time is, you know, people don't have that much time. Then comes digital one, technology thing. 30 years ago, 25 years ago, we had VHS, you know, 2 hours you could put in that. And in fact, if those 2 hours were really full, you felt good that you got 2 hours. If it was only 1 hour, you know, the feeling was that another remaining space was wasted. No? You paid same amount of money, but you got only 49 minutes out of it. If you got, you know, 120 minutes, it was great. Today it's not great. It's other way around. Now can you believe even the chapters? John is there, and I know that myself, Ralph, many of people of our time, we are in certain areas, we are outdated. We are obsolete. These people are, this is their time, you know, this is their era. Now I'm giving lecture, I'm preparing Yoga Sutra Master Course. Book is coming out. With that is Yoga Sutra Master Course. Okay. A set of 4 weekend seminars. Each seminar has 8 to 10 lectures. No? Those 10 lectures, 1 hour. That was when we started our Living Tantra. In last 5 years' time, human mind has got changed. Now, 1 hour, just one thing, just you go on, Panditji, you keep talking. No. So now we settle down with 10 minute segment, 8 to 10 minutes of chapters. Within a lecture, there are chapters. Now, teachers are expected to have those small bites. Why? Person might be cooking, so that when he or she wants to come back, you know, puts on pause, or let's turn off, and later on you just quickly see that which chapter you are in. You are already there. You have to provide lecture notes. You have to provide little device where they can make their own notes. No? On top of that, there has to be another extra version of your lecture. Totally different kinds of, you know, camera shot. No? Which can go on the handheld devices. Majority of the people are no longer studying these subjects on their computers or even laptops. They are on their iPads, and most of them, majority is now actually on iPhones and smartphones. Totally different methodology. Now, this is a time for teachers to really have sympathy with what is happening out there. No? And prepare. As a teacher, I have to prepare myself. No? So I have given full freedom to our young generation there in Hansdale. There are 5-7 of them. All of them are, you know, somewhere. Many of them are not even 30 years old. They are 25, in the range of 25. I think you are the senior most probably. No, you are not. No. But yeah, he is in there. No. So, this is what we need to really understand. This is one. This is called production side. This is called delivery side. But what is really from, let's say, from my standpoint where I come from and where my knowledge, my experience can be most utilized in the current context is something what I have been seeing. In 2001, I traveled almost, I started with 60 city and it turned into 100 city tour. You know, in 2001. I'm traveling almost every part of the world. China, Japan, Hong Kong, European countries, the United States, India, and different cities, lecturing, teaching. And what is happening here, I'm seeing this, how the things are blending. On one hand. Another hand, things are also disintegrating. A segment of our society is falling apart. There are 300 million people in India. They go to bed hungry every day. 300 million. 300 those and plus another 300 other million people in India, they earn less than $2 a day. Another 300-400 million people in China. 600 million people in African continent. Few hundred million such people in Latin America, South America, almost like 2 billion people out there. They are in a not so great condition. With poverty comes illiteracy. Poverty and illiteracy combined comes ill health. When illiteracy, poverty and ill health, bad health, then comes desperation, anger. Anger leads to violence. We talk about economy of one country, for example, the United States of America. Today's American economy, European economy, Indian economy, Chinese economy, they are completely tied with the economy of the whole planet. We may or may not notice it. No. India has not put its own acts together. Therefore, now, so many of our manufacturing is coming back to the United States. Thank God, our educational infrastructure is superb in the world. It is only when you have not traveled abroad, then you can say that here quality of our education in America is declining. But once you travel the rest of the world, then you will say that how lucky we are. The kind of universities and libraries and labs you see in the United States, it is unprecedented. with the exception of few European countries. The rest of the world is far, far, far behind. And therefore, we have ability to really perceive. We have ability to see what may happen 10 years from today, 15 years from today. Lots of people out there, they don't have that ability. And we have ability to prepare ourselves to meet the challenges. You know? A Himalayan Institute is also in the same league. People, they talk about, yes, in India, such and such organization, such and such guru has 300 million followers. Come on. You know, there is a, you know, somebody asked me how Indian people in India, outrightly, they believe that I'm a liar. Why? When they ask me this question, how many members you have? And if I say 2,500, immediately they think that I'm lying. Because there are, you know, just really, literally people without much qualification or anything, just somebody has a temple and few followers, and they write on their, you know, in their literature, the Babaji, Mahatmaji, Swamiji has, you know, 10 million followers throughout the planet. You know, fake, you know. Even if they have, what kind of impact do they have? Almost zero, other than creating riot between Hindus and Muslims, you know, and things like that. And so we are very uniquely situated organizations. You know, in last 44, 45 years' time, you know, Himalayan Institute was officially established in 1971. So 44 years, and few years even before that, unofficially, we existed. So we have a great advantage of knowing this world at a totally different level. We are not Hindus, we are not Muslims, we are not Christians, we are everything. No? We are everything. We have the best of the best from the Bible, from the Quran, from Bhagavad Gita, from the Upanishads, you know. And we have discovered the very essence of our humanness. You know? This is a great thing. Now, how to bring forward that? We cannot say, well, we will change the whole world, but we can do whatever we can by using our resources. Within the country where we operate and outside the country where we operate. And this is what I'll say, that today, tradition should do, and we are already doing. And through God's grace, blessings of great masters and teachers, and with the help of, you know, every all supporters, we are doing something very, very significant. Anybody who goes to Africa, it's mind-blowing. With small resources, we have our permanent place. So please, yeah, little sidebar I can say, you know, next April 2015, soon, I think Jeff is getting ready to announce his, what do you call that? Matching.
Yeah, it's going to be the Total Health or the Health Revolution Challenge.
Health Revolution Challenge in Africa. Just last year, my daughter, by the way, she completed her master's from Boston University in public health and joined Africa full force. And Jeff Chelsea, a lot. And Steve and many, many other people. So we did big project. And now when these children, they talk about, you know, that 80,000 people benefiting from our work. That tells something. And that without making a big deal, without making a big show, you know, in reality it's there. So people go there and they and so this is kind of thing here we should contemplate. Identify first. Identify what is going on here in the United States. What is going on elsewhere. What is there that we can do with our existing resources in the United States and elsewhere. What is there we further unfold, you know, turn our dormant potentials and awaken those, you know, dormant potentials and further utilize those potentials. So here is few things I'll say. First, being for such a long period of time in existence, we have a large population who know us and we know them. And we have ability to serve them. How? By bringing the meditative dimension of yoga back into their life. You are lucky here in this center. It is due to the fact that our all senior members, under the leadership of Ralph and Mary Gale, we continued maintaining our philosophy and policy that on which the Himalayan Institute was founded here in Buffalo. In many, many other locations, that has been lost. No. Quote, competition. Competition in what area? Asana, which is not our the only strength. Asana is just a particular aspect of institute's offering. There are so many other things. Now we have reached a place where we are in need of that aspect of Himalayan Institute's knowledge and wisdom, which not very many other organizations have it. Things in the United States, you know, in the West, it comes like a fad. No. And we are not fad-driven kind of people. We have something that has been tested, documented for thousands of years. We know something very simple, that it is easy to have a very motivational kind of, you know, inspirational, motivational talk. You know? Like a holistic health evangelist kind of. You know? And just because there is a product on turmeric product. How long and how many things can you connect to the turmeric? Turmeric is good thing, no doubt about it. But life is more than turmeric. No? Thank God. The kind of organization we are, the kind of people we are, we have come to this realization and we know it. And our whole life is not based on turmeric. No. Therefore, we do not need to just tap into that so-called fad which has just come. Fad lasts only for a few years. It's gone. So you have shea nut butter, fad. Jojoba oil, fad. And this fad, it just comes and goes and suddenly it's replaced by something else. You know? What cannot be replaced is the need for having a really peaceful, joyful, clear, tranquil, and calm mind. That is a reality that cannot be denied. You know? Need for having a healthy, energetic body. The body that listens to our mind. And the mind that understands the need of our soul. And a philosophy of life which has a respectful place for true love, unconditional love and compassion. Now it is really time to, yes, use your digital technology. Use your all that, you know, marketing, you know, talent, you know. Package it properly. And present this lovely stuff to human beings. This is a reality that cannot be denied. Who in the world, okay, regardless you are young or you are old, regardless you have access to or you don't have access to all the most expensive purses or, you know, shoes or cars, is any of you here feels that living a really clear, calm, tranquil, uncomplicated, joyful life is not in need? How many of you think that this joy stuff and happiness stuff, peace stuff is? No? No? Now, Yes, this is where we need to do something in a much more, you know, systematic manner. And systematic means which is easily available. How can we reach? You know, competition is there. It's a, you know, the word which I used to laugh, but now it has, again, I have also adopted to. It's called e-blast. You have heard the word e-blast. Here in this center, 25 years ago, we had extremely simple mailing system here. Mary Gail and few people. In fact, it's hard to say. Jackie. Jackie, you are here. It was like at Jackie's fingertips. Designing a brochure in a matter of half hour time. And especially the kind of, you know, brochure and flyer we needed 20 years ago, it was extremely simple. You know, a flyer, probably it's one color, maximum two colors, you know. Write down the name of the, you know, program and seminars and classes and put the dates, you know, and write it in a manner that it is readable. And we used to keep it here and 3-4 times a year, just mail it to people, and people understood the value of it. I visited, you know, 25 years ago, I had more time. I used to go, you know, the Mark and Mariana, we used to go and have, you know, swim in her, you know, swimming pool. Children, my children used to come, her children, they just, you know, we had plenty of time, and I used to watch and see, and so I have lots of people's homes I have been, you know, doing havan at your place. You know, life has become little busy otherwise. And in those days, I used to see. Sometimes I used to see the flyers, expired flyers sitting at people's homes. If I really wrote, there was a flyer and brochure on that, or let's say if I wrote a letter, there wasn't a doubt in people's mind that it is a mass mailing. It is like, yes, if it's signed by Panditji, it is really signed by Panditji. Okay. Now, phenomena of e-blast. Anything you do, here is e-blast. 50,000 people, 100,000 people are getting it. And similarly, everybody is doing the same thing. Now, if Himalayan Institute does not do, we are doomed. And we have to do it along with everybody else. So, so many things now, in order to make an impact, you have to reach people exactly the way now people are becoming, or people have become used to reaching them. Now we are talking about meditation, talking about the Yoga Sutra, talking about, you know, such, let's say, relaxation techniques, meditative techniques, which actually, the truth is that they take time. There is nothing like you got 5 minutes recipe, and in 5 minutes time you overcome your 50 year long habits. No, but expectations are given there. No, 5 minutes time, 5 formulas. No, now how to really reach people with the Yoga Sutra, which essentially tells us that yoga is experiential science. And experience comes from practice. Practice requires that you continue doing it for a long period of time without interruption, and you do it with love and respect. How long? 5 minutes a day, 5 times a week? 10 minutes? Is it 6 month long course? Do I get certificate? No? Now, we should not be surprised. Now mind is thinking that way. No. This is a challenge. what here I am suggesting, that please continue doing your practice. Because practice is the only thing that will make you perfect. You know? And continue aspiring to be more peaceful, more joyful, more unperturbed, even in during such situations and circumstances when there is justifiable reason to be disturbed and distracted. You know? Yeah. And that's what we should be aspiring for. No? And it is in that context our ancient wisdom has to be again presented. In this context, I will say, in our tradition, there are many, many, really literally thousands of texts. People continued sharing their knowledge. But three texts have been taken as most important. The Yoga Sutra of Patanjali, Saundarya Lahari, which is one of the most esoteric. Yoga Sutra is really not that esoteric. It's terse, I'll say. It's compact. And it is, at times, it's cryptic, very, very condensed. But a good part of it is very easily understood. It can be understood and can be put into practice. Saundarya Lahari, on the other hand, is very esoteric, mystical. And then there is another scripture called Kalpa Sutra, Parashurama Kalpa Sutra. Like you call it Patanjali's Yoga Sutra. Similarly, there is another great master, his name is Parashurama, and his text is called Kalpa Sutra. And that is where the lots of practices, but in a very methodical manner, have been described. And from all these three texts, another master in 11th century, 10th century AD, who had the two students who became the kings, he wrote big gigantic books. So these are 3+1 books. They are like the texts which cover the entire range of what is there in our tradition. And then from there, something more health-oriented, something more mind-oriented, something more spirituality-oriented, something asana, pranayama, bandha, mudra, lifestyle, something just simply building, creating a philosophy of life and abiding with it. So there are many, 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 you know, aspects of the traditional wisdom that has been passed on to us. And what I am very much interested, God knows how I got that much interested lately in the last 3-4 years' time, perhaps my own age, perhaps I'm seeing my own friends, many of us, we're just really young. No? Now, many of the people in early 80s, they used to come and we used to go skiing, sledding. None of those people are really excited to do sledding. Back is hurting, this is hurting, that is hurting. No? And so when they come, now I sit down with them in the conference room and have chai. No? So, therefore, this is what has inspired me. Bring the Yoga Sutra and really just teach, teach, teach. Swami Veda started this project almost 20, 25. How many of you do you know Swami Veda? Yeah, few are here. He started, first book came out almost maybe 20 years ago, maybe even earlier, the first volume. And Swamiji kept telling not to really care for what other previous commentators and scholars have said about this sutra and about the Yoga Sutra. Just simply do what is good and do it in a manner that which is useful and good for the practitioners. You cannot satisfy everybody in the world, academic and non-academic, those who are practice-oriented, looking for how to practice Yoga Sutra. And And then his health wasn't that great. So again, teaching part, you know, we wrote the book. Teaching part, he couldn't do, you know, the way he could have done if you were, you know, young and, you know, and healthy. And by the way, you know, just I heard a couple of, 2 days ago, he's not doing well. He was in Delhi, you know. I just got an email, you know. And let us pray for him, you know, see. And so, I think you don't know. One of our most senior, you know, teachers in the tradition, and Swamiji is very, 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 you know, I think the most senior among all of us. And but he has been living. He took renunciates, you know, the vows of renunciation several years, almost 20 years ago, and mostly lives, you know, in Rishikesh. So the Yoga Sutra. From Yoga Sutra, then let us see, you know, more of the things by using the knowledge of Yoga Sutra and by combining it with Ayurveda and holistic health and everything else, then create a new programs which addresses a particular type of, you know, concerns and issues, you know, and offers a very unique kind of you know, service to our mankind, and especially the people, those who are haunted of modern concerns and difficulties in life, you know. And then from there, from same Yoga Sutra, then here comes to more of the spiritual dimension of it, which is more meditative. And meditation, this is what I'm, you know, feeling quite bad, that what will happen to the tradition of yoga when just a few handful remaining teachers, those who integrate the meditative and spiritual dimension of yoga into their asana, when they are gone. So this is a time that we go very vigorously by using every tools and means that is available, by using tricks, by using wit, by doing anything that is needed. We have to bring, you know, that aspect of yoga, you know, back into our, you know, daily, you know, teaching and daily practice. And that's meditative. And that part which I'm feeling that 2017 is the time. Let the Yoga Sutra is just about to come. And what I'm doing it, I had a luxury of studying with two most prominent teachers. Of course, I studied as part of my Sanskrit training, then I studied at the university, but I had two masters. One is Swamiji and another great sage, great master, great yogi, Swami Sadananda. And from 1973, wow, 41 years, somehow I had my system of making notes in my head and on the paper. There are few, you know, my wife is the one who preserves all those notes. You know, otherwise, probably I could have lost all that. I had the privilege of learning while sitting at the feet of these masters and their practical application of each sutra. And in my intro, very humbly, I have told, you know, that why I'm writing the way I'm writing, you know, and therefore it is all practice oriented. So 2014 comes out the first volume, 2015 I have already started, it's already in the process, book cover is already designed. So 2014, 15, 16 and 17. So this is the Yoga Sutra, the era of Yoga Sutra. And that is by that time, automatically, my guess is, many of you will come forward by yourself, and all I will need to do is just simply remind, isn't that you have been studying? Yes, that means meditation. You already know it. What we will need is, at that time, the system of meditation that we have learned here is the entire support system, whole infrastructure for teaching, learning, practicing meditation is there. In modern times, one of the biggest problems which people are having, that their foundation is not strong enough. And therefore, they have people have hard time distinguishing which kind of meditation, which kind of practice is correct, meaning more authentic and more straightforward and more effective than the other. This criteria, we do not know exactly how to decide that. But see, why are we not confused about the electricity? You know, when we buy an electrical appliances, we know exactly what is the criteria for a particular merchandise to be good and not so good. We have basic knowledge about it. Whereas in the field of, you know, yoga, meditation, and spirituality, even to great degree health, we don't have the actual foundation really solid. As a result, a teacher comes from India, self-proclaimed teacher, sits in the restaurant in Holland, and it's a real story. And this gentleman from a Dutch fellow, they both are sitting on the dining table asking, this Dutch fellow says, so where are you from? I'm from India. Oh my God, you are from India? Yeah. So you must be meditating? Oh yeah, everybody in India meditates. Wow. Can you teach me? Sure. So by the time dinner is over, this fellow taught meditation to this Dutch fellow, and he pulled out a tiny little passport-sized photo of a lady. And he says, just put it in the frame, or you can enlarge it and just look at this photo picture and bring that picture right in your heart and just think of it. Many, many years went by, and this person is doing meditation. Somewhere he read Living with the Himalayan Masters. I say, hey, better I should double check. No? There is a story in Living with Himalayan Masters about a donkey, a washerman. His entire wealth, property was a donkey. One day he lost his donkey and he was very upset and he went in coma. So he was many days in coma and there were some crooks in the village. They made a big deal of this fellow going into coma. He said, he's a great master, we never knew, and wow, our village is blessed, and he's in Samadhi. And those crooks, they started collecting money from the other, you know, simple-minded villagers. And this fellow remained in coma for 3-4 days. And when he came out from the coma, the first thing he said, where is my donkey? So, if you go into your so-called samadhi while meditating on donkey, you will emerge with the, you know, knowledge pertaining to donkey. That's the extent of your enlightenment. So this person read this story in the Living with Himalayan Masters. He said, better I should. It means the quality of your meditative object is even more important than the process of concentrating on it. So what is this? So this person wrote me a letter. And along with that photo. So I was born and raised in the village, so I was not very much familiar with Indian Bollywood, you know, the Indian movie industry. My wife, thanks God, she was raised more in city. So I gave this thing. I said, Meera, do you recognize this picture? Something, it looks like it's familiar to me. My wife said, yeah. What's that? It's Rekha. It's Rekha, one of the actresses. I said, what? Yeah, it's Rekha. I had to be very careful how to guide that gentleman. He had been meditating with so much faith and love and respect, you know. And I have to be a little gentle. So very gently then I talked to him. And then finally he came. Then I told him that this is a photo of an actress, Indian actress. Now, he did not know the difference between an actress and a picture of a goddess. Let's put it that way. Sometimes, just because we do not know, we have no way of really figuring out whether it is right thing to meditate on, right way to meditate or not. And Yoga Sutra is a very, very profound scripture, you know. It lasted for thousands of years only because it is so well grounded in direct experiences of the masters, those who dedicated their whole life to do the sadhana. Therefore, once the book is ready and we have read, you know, the whole thing, and we have gone through all this in-depth study and thing, you know, the master courses automatically will become teacher. Not because we are planning to be a teacher, just because we ended up being a very good student. A good student is the one who is the good teacher. You know, if we do not do the practice, and if we don't have our own direct experience, and if we have not seen all our own strengths and weaknesses and how to overcome our weaknesses and become stronger, then we'll be just simply memorizing those rules, those guidelines of meditation, and just helping others to memorize it. You know? So experience really counts. Therefore, you study, you practice, you gain experience, and in a completely effortless manner, suddenly turns out that you are the best teacher. You know? And many, many of us are ready, and especially the kind of environment we have been, you know, creating and maintaining for decades, you know. So this is where Institute is, this is where the Himalayan tradition is, this is where we are, and this is where I will stop, and now you may ask some questions if you have in your mind. And by the way, what I have something very, very special for Africa. For India, India is very unique, you know, country. There is best of the best, worst of the worst. India is a land of extremes and contrasts. You go to the certain places, it's like the places themselves emit unique energy. You go to other places, you can see, my God, such a extreme materialism and just chaos and, you know, commotion. So both are there. But in Africa, there is a really need. Not necessarily at this moment need for so-called spiritual wisdom, but if we introduce rightly, correctly, one day it will have great application. Right now what Africa needs is a totally different kind of spirituality. That is health, education, you know, and poverty elimination, and anything that we could do by, you know, while teaching them how to take care of their land, their soil, their natural resources, how to, you know, grow more food, you know, that will be the best. Just imagine a country like Cameroon where we have our center. Per capita GDP, you know, in Africa, in Cameroon is around $700 per person. Just imagine. And out of that, huge portion of it is concentrated in the hands of just few handful, you know, individuals. And it is in that country where beautiful climate, really literally very beautiful climate. It's a country of around 20, 21 million people's country, you know, population. You know, guess how much rice they are importing. In just 50 years ago, Cameroon had plenty of rice to feed itself and even to export. Now, Cameroon imports, just guess how much rice per year? $500,000 tons. What does it mean? There is shortage of food. People literally eat whatever is growing right there. In the place where we are, in Kumbo, greenery everywhere, beautiful hills and mountains. And shocking thing is, not one single animal, not one single bird. Once while you see some crow. John, you just literally they have eaten everything. On the roadside, once while you see bush rats and frogs. It is that shortage of food. Land is beautiful. They are able to, cassava grows everywhere. Plantain grows everywhere. But how much, and this is all starchy food, and that's what their main food is. Their main food is cassava and plantain. When I was there, during the first few visits, I couldn't understand. There was just small size, like a very, very small size pear. They call it pear. Very small size, but it's not pear. It's a very big pit inside, and there is flesh between the skin and the pit. Very just tiny, just small little thin layer of some, you know, meat. And very tarred, sour. And they roast it. And people are just, you know, scratching it with their teeth. So first I was curious, what is this? Out of curiosity, I took a bite, and there is a pit in here, nothing in there. And that's what people are, you know, just selling on the roadside. Just as, you know, you have barbecue here, you know, on the roadside. In the summer, similarly, on the roadside. And in that kind of environment, if we can, now, and we have the land there, you know, but the land where we got is 50 hectares, something like that, Kishan. Unfortunately, very beautiful land, but it's too cold for the kind of things that we want. And infrastructure is horrible. During the rainy season, you can't even reach there, you know. And with four-wheel drive, if you are driving, if you get stuck, if you are lucky, you can, you know, come out. Otherwise, you are stuck. You know? You have to walk. So that bad is infrastructure. So like in that kind of climate and that kind of country, even if we teach people how to grow rice, how to process it, you know, remove the husk, if we can create, and this is what we have done, just the with our public health and total health products, no, we taught them. Now 90% of our total health products are grown right there, and we grind them. We have grinding machines, we have capsule making machines, and we have, you know, all programs about health. People come, get trained, get, you know, full education, then they are sent back to the villages. So this is as good. It is as good. Spirituality, you know, meditation and health, etc., is as good for us. It is that good to them, you know. They got food, you know. 200 children per day, they come and study in our library. And computer, they have computer, they have, you know, access to internet. And then a special chamber, you know, for just children. 200 people every day attending our library. That's something very good. This is their kind of spirituality. 20 years from today, the way their GDP growth is rising, the way things are happening, their GDP growth is somewhere in the range of 7%. You know, neighboring countries even higher. And if the things continue growing this way, then very soon they will have 10 to 12% GDP growth. That means in next 20 years' time, you know, they will be in quite good shape. And that is the time they will have reason to study the Yoga Sutra. No? Right now, let us figure out how to help them grow rice, how to help them have food, you know, and how to have, you know, shoes, you know, clothes, you know. Those are kinds of things. And this is how different models of services, you know, and it is in this context, in different societies, different cultures, different times, different places. We keep introducing different levels of different tiers of spiritual wisdom. You know? And this is what, you know, I feel that this is what we should be doing.
Yeah. With all that need all over the world, how do you come to terms with taking care of this little section here? And putting out of my mind, or not putting out of my mind, but not being upset with everything everywhere else.
Paul, here is the reason. First thing you look at, where is Mother Nature, where is the divine providence really leading you, guiding you? First, I went to, after Swamiji died, we started things South India. All kinds of things we did. Enormous amount of work until 2003-04. And we kept seeing that there is something nature is telling that this is not your place. Then we started in East Africa. Then from there, a group of four, myself, Ishan, and two barristers, one barrister from, and both were barristers in England, but one is from India, another is from Sierra Leone. Four of us, we traveled West Africa. In a such a mysterious way we landed, after traveling many, many, many countries, we landed Kumbo. We saw one of the most bizarre things you can imagine. Infrastructure which is at least half a million square foot space, or the co-op.
I'm not sure.
Humongous, just literally humongous, let's put it this way. Humongous. My guess is at least half a million square foot. At some point, 30 years ago, they were processing around 7 to 10,000 tons of coffee. And in '80s, they bought a rice mill. They brought it. By the time they brought it, they got in fight, and the whole, for last 30 years, 25 years, that even the rice mill, all the equipment is sitting in junk. From 7,000 to 10,000 ton of processing of coffee, and it was at the village level. The villagers used to grow in their homes, you know, in their farmland, sell, and that was their major source of income and livelihood. Now, they hardly have 10, 20 tons per year. Just sits there. So, my God, if we revive it, thousands of people will get job, and the whole, in whole society here, children will start going to school. That was the trigger point. Things kept, you know, moving. And then thereafter. Now here, it's not what we have done, but rather how we did is even more precious than what we did. Now, because of that, people from neighboring towns and states and countries, they come to Kumbo to learn. So, like, Dalai Lama's group came. So they stayed there for a month, 2 months. You were there at that time when Jimmy came? Yeah, His Holiness Ministry of Agriculture in Exile, you know, sent. And we gave all the scholarship, we took care of all their expenses. They came there and learned. And then they went back. And then that's when we implemented this plantation, big, gigantic plantation project and biodiesel project in South India in Tibetan settlements. So see here the impact. Now, similarly, Ghana and Ivory Coast and people, we had in 2008, we had conference. People came from Senegal and Ghana and Ivory Coast and Bangladesh, you know, they came and they saw the model. Now the model is so correct, so perfect. With that model, it's like you can just replicate it anywhere. And it is that strength that is now, you know, inspiring us, you know, that we can go in any part of Africa. It took 7 years to reach wherever we reached. And it took around $3 million, you know, to accomplish this far. Now our... Just general operation is somewhere in the range of $100,000. You know, that includes even some of our travel expense. But if someone else has to do it, still our operation is not less than $1 million operation per year. That much is running up, you know, running cost of that operation. $1 million minimum, maybe even more. But for us, $100,000. Because the model is so perfect. Local participation is so perfect. So it's culture. It's their habits, cultural habits, and their religion, their mental and intellectual resources, everything together, we combined and model is perfect. So now therefore we can expand. So question is, problem is everywhere. Why one place, not the other? Just watch and see, where is divine providence really taking you? And do it. Let me give you another example. There are certain things, they continue doing their magic even after you have been gone, you know, after you leave this planet. Andrew Carnegie's work, out of many, many, one work is, he established 2,500 libraries throughout the world. And 1,800 libraries are outside the United States of America. Only 700 are in this country. Almost 100 years or so have gone by. You just imagine the impact that man made by having this 2,500 libraries. 1,800 of them outside the United States. Wherever you go, you know, this library originally funded by, established by Carnegie Mellon Foundation. So these kinds of things you just do wherever you see. And just as when you do a business, always look at where in least amount of time, with least amount of energy, you know, financial and mental and intellectual, you are going to make the most impact and lasting impact. Even though it is spiritually oriented thing, you don't need to worry about what the outcome, but we are human beings, we should pay attention to that thing. In less time, with less money, you know, the most impact, lasting impact. With that, just see what is the best place. The place why we chose this one, Kumbho, it's English-speaking part of French country. And some basic infrastructure is still there, and disease is not there, and hunger, starvation is not there. There we can create an army of fully trained people. We can teach people in carpentry, construction, electricity, brick making, tablet making, you know, herbs, and then we can deploy them everywhere. If God wishing, we may start something else. You know, now the governments are inviting us, you know. Now, big offers are coming. They can clearly see. And when people, so what we do, we have a system. If you want to ask to come and do something for you, first you come and see Cameroon. If possible, come and see Hansdale. And if you can also see India, go to Allahabad, go to Khajuraho and see what we have done and what is our capacity and how. Then you invite us, we will come, and then we will set up the system. The latest which I'm hoping that we will do, we create a model of approximately minimum of 1,000-acre land in these countries. The thing is, in most of this, there is just as 100, 150 years ago, this scramble of Africa was happening, same thing is happening. It's called land grabbing. Just 60 million acre land, arable land of Africa is now owned by non-Africans, you know, and companies. Just imagine. Now, in that context, if Himalayan Institute starts a project and really sets an example how to do good, healthy agriculture without practicing the phenomena of monocropping in a manner which is good for the local people, good for the environment. And in that context, if we can integrate our global community, we will not necessarily that we'll do lots of, you know, farming, but we'll create model. And that many, many people, they will get inspired. Americans, unfortunately, our young generation in the United States universities are now trying their best to send their students, like John's sister is being sent as part of her college education to different countries. But Americans have become too insulated. They do not know exactly what's going on in the world. And as a result, Americans are losing their ground in many aspects of global community. You know, not everywhere we should or we can go with our military power, you know, to do something good and just defend human rights and justice. You know, that is not the best way. But best way is actually through education and through our hard work. Even the spirit of our Peace Corps is gone. It's not exactly the same with the intention and the spirit which started Peace Corps, you know, in 60s. It's no longer there. Even the people go with this attitude that I'm going to save the planet. The thing is, it's not true. Wherever you are not going as a savior. Go there with different attitude and intention and look at the opportunity so that you get established and in a very sustainable manner do something now. You know? That was the Kennedy's, you know, intention, that let our boys and girls go there and see what this world is all about. And you create a system where you transform poverty into prosperity in a sustainable manner. That's the best way to help, you know. And this is what I feel, that Institute can take a leadership role because we have the resources. Resources, not necessarily we are loaded with money, but we have human resource. We have the respect of the people, you know, and many people outside America also understand what Institute is doing in the United States, and therefore that is what, like in Mexico, we don't need to be in Mexico anymore. You know, we did it and we handed over to Puebla University and this child. What is that other?
Child
fund. They are doing very good job. Our work is over. So even without doing anything, still we will continue doing our work in Mexico. Yeah. So this is the model we are talking about. Yeah. Thank you very much. Really, I was missing Buffalo. You know, it's a long time. You know, long time. So.
It's the best word day to come.
So, Paul, do you accept my apology?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, yes, thank you, thank you, thank you.
I'm glad you came.
No, I'll come back with some good news. Give me time, maybe not April, maybe too early. Something, I want to do something in Africa where India and United Kingdom and United States, many group up, and many yoga centers. I want to create a model. First, let me do my own homework. You know, once homework is completed, then let's do something really fantastic. You know, and in Africa, there is poverty. At the same time, one thing what I have noticed in Africa, unlike people in India, the people of Africa are willing to learn and do something. In India, this subsidy policy of the government of India is really hurting the India. And this caste-based subsidy and reservations is hurting India. And instead of India doing something in the field of education and infrastructure, they are just giving a small amount of money. And that money is like making, not inspiring people. People are not using it. So the children still don't go to school. You know? And agriculture is struggling in India. Education is struggling in India. It's very difficult. We are seeing it in Allahabad as well as in Khajuraho. To find a skilled sweeper, you can't find it. It really takes, it's mind-blowing. We had such a painful experience finding somebody during the Kumbh Mela to help us clean bathrooms. No? So we had 16 plus, around 35, 36 bathrooms. Jeff, Chelsea, Ishan, Alad, we were the one doing the cleaning because it's associated with caste system. Sweeping is not considered to be impure job because there it's associated with impurity, religious impurity, rather than actual sanitary or unsanitary impurity. So this whole thing is so convoluted. Something is like our shrine. The toilet in our shrine is so clean that even ordinary people's, even upper middle class people's living room is not as clean as our toilet. No? And yet, a village person one day refused to use the same cleaning material from the packet from which the cleaning material was taken in order to clean the toilet in the shrine. Because now that packet got touched by some untouchable caste. My God, how much more human mind could be, dense. That is where, and people don't want to learn. Many times I thought of, our carpentry construction school in Cameroon is one of the best in the entire country. It's doing just magic there. And you go to India, all the furniture are imported and the local craftsmanship is so poor. We got 40 chairs made and within one day time, out of 40, 9 or 10 chairs, this thing just came off. So every chair had to be redone, by our own people. Steve had to fix it. That poor. But you can't teach the carpentry because carpentry belongs to a very unique caste in India called Lohar, Barhi. And those people, they are in such a small... They themselves are suffering from inferiority complex. They think that they are lower caste people and they shrink in the corner of the society. Even if and upper caste people don't feel any reason to help them really gain their skill. If they gain the skill, their qualification will go up and they will become part of, economically they will succeed. And therefore, economically successful lower caste person will become a problem to the upper caste person. And that's how upper caste people are thinking. My God, I think at this stage in my life, I don't have time for India. Let me just simply talk about spirituality, Vedas and the Upanishads and the Yoga Sutra. There are lots of people over there, those who know this subject, and our American friends and international community will enjoy Khajuraho and Allahabad. Forget this thing. Whereas in Africa, this is not the case. The people really come to study and learn, and as soon as they study, they learn, and if you can also give them just little bit of startup money. And they work very hard. And that is the fate of Africa. It looks like somewhere at much, much bigger level, divine providence has decided that this continent, people of this continent, those who have been suffering for a long time, now it's their time to rise. It's happening. So thank you very much. It's really so wonderful to see all of you here. Thank you.